Ephesians chapter 5 verse 28 to chapter 6 verse 3, the 20th talk in a series on Ephesians, was presented by Jack Crabtree on December 2, 2018 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Jack Crabtree and is being made available to you by Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. Contributions to Jack Crabtree may be made at www.soundinterp.wordpress.com. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. Handout number 12, translation, installment 10, accompanies this talk.
So we're in Ephesians, and we are in basically the section, paragraph 32, 33, and 34 in my translation, chapter 5, 22 through 33 in the normal Bible. But two questions came up last week, and I want to address those questions first, and then we'll come back and finish paragraph 34, which is where we left off. The email to me said, was characterizing or digesting what I said as, if a woman marries, it is her job to help and support the purpose of the man she married, trying to explain how the husband is the head of his wife here in this passage, which goes back to Genesis, where Adam is the head and Eve is the helper, etzer in Hebrew. So I'm not sure what I said, but it's being characterized here as, if a woman marries, it is her job to help and support the purposes of the man she married. Man does not have that same job toward his wife. So what should guide us when roles in a marriage are seemingly reversed? The husband is supporting the role of the wife. Okay, now, I think there are a lot of traditional readings of this passage that would say, well, they shouldn't be reversed. Now, that's not how I'm reading it. That's not how I'm understanding it. But I think in order to articulate how I'm understanding how Paul understands Genesis, we have to make a distinction between a role and something else, and I'm going to struggle for language here. I'm just going to call it a life path. And what I mean, so let's go back to the garden. Adam is created, and the path is laid out for him. Certain tasks, certain responsibilities, a certain outlook on who he is and where he's going or where he's supposed to be going, but he's set down a path to pursue this path in his life. Well, he's already on his path and headed down the path before Eve even comes into being, before Eve is even created. That's the sense in which Genesis calls Eve an etzer, a helper. And I've said this in the past, I don't think I said it last week. It's important to keep in mind, because sometimes the word help can have a kind of negative connotation in our culture. When we think of a helper, we think of a lower class, lower social class, somebody who is not educated and all they can do is be help, right? We hire them to be help. So it can have that kind of connotation of being relatively insignificant and not certainly not as important as the people that they're helping, okay? Etzer in Hebrew clearly doesn't have that connotation, because as often as not, the word etzer in the Bible is used to describe Yahweh. Yahweh is an etzer of Israel, the helper of Israel. Okay, so it's not because he's inferior, it's not because he's inadequate, it's not because he's incompetent, nothing of the sort. He's the etzer of Israel because Israel's on a certain path, a certain history, and they get themselves in a pickle of one kind or another, and they need an Eitzer to come along and help them get out of the pickle that they're in, whatever that might be. But the reason Yahweh is the Eitzer and not the head in that relationship, Israel is the head in that relationship, because they are the member of the relationship that defines the difficulty that needs to be solved. It's their pickle, not God's pickle. It's their problem, not God's problem. So God comes along and helps Israel get out of or solve their problem, right? So it's a helper Eitzer is always an asymmetrical relationship, because there's always one member of the relationship who basically gives definition to whatever needs definition in the relationship. They are the defining member of the relationship. The relationship is what it is because of this member. And then the Eitzer is the partner in that relationship, the counterpart in the relationship, who is, whose being is defined in relationship to the head of the relationship. Okay? So God, Yahweh, is defined in relationship to the head of his relationship with his people Israel. When we're talking about him solving one of their problems, they are the head, the defining member of the relationship, and God is the one whose role is defined in relationship to that. But there's nothing, it doesn't denigrate God at all to call him the Eitzer of Israel. It's important to see that. Okay, so let me make a distinction between a role and a life plan or life path. Headship, I would argue, is defined in relationship to one's life path, not in relationship to one's role. Roles are defined in a variety of different ways. Society helps define the roles of husband and wife. Biology helps define the roles of husband and wife. Individual preferences and individual talents and abilities within a marriage help define the roles within a marriage. There's all kinds of factors that come in and impact how an individual husband and an individual wife will see their roles in the relationship. And there's nothing in Genesis, and I would argue here, there's nothing in 1 Corinthians that specifies or commands us to adopt a certain kind of role. That's not what is at issue in 1 Corinthians, and it's not what Genesis is talking about. It rather is talking about how do we understand our life path. And do I understand my life path as just something that I, as an individual, find, discover, and pursue? Well, we all do that. That's not the right way to put it. Do I understand my life path as something that just is mine, unmediated, is the important issue? Or do I find my life path as mediated through another person that I'm related to? The asymmetry of the marriage relationship is Adam, as the head of that partnership, had his life path defined for him through an unmediated relationship to his creator. Eve had her life path, discovered her life path by choosing to be, if she didn't have much of a choice in her case, but by choosing to be related to a man. And her life path is mediated by the man that she's married to. She is the Eitzer to him. So he's got a life path, okay, me too. I'm going on that life path too, to be an etzer to the man that I have committed my life to, and not vice versa. That's the asymmetry of the relationship. You don't have a relationship, you don't have a situation where Eve has a life path set for her and she pursues it, and then a man decides, I'm going to marry Eve and I'm going to be the etzer to her. I'm going to journey on her life path with her and help her and be an etzer to her. That Paul's perspective is that what Genesis is doing is teaching us something about God's purposes, the order of creation that God created. He created marriage to be asymmetrical in a particular kind of direction, with the husband as the head and the wife as the etzer. Now, what's critical to see, and I'm confident of this now, I've suspected it, but I haven't had confidence to say this in the past. What gets debated is what's being defined in Ephesians the relationship between a man and a woman, or between a husband and a wife? Well, I think we can see, having kind of come through the front door in Ephesians, it's a husband and a wife. This is a particular established social relationship that the early Jesus believers are wanting to say, does that apply to us any longer? To which he's saying, absolutely, that applies. If you are a wife to a husband, it's perfectly acceptable to stay a wife to a husband and not be disloyal to your Lord, to your Messiah. That's perfectly acceptable. But we're talking about marriage there. We're talking about marriage, we're talking about the parent-child relationship, and then we're talking about the master-slave relationship. This is nowhere in the picture is the male-female relationship here. So we have to ask the question, what about a woman who doesn't make a choice to marry a man? What about her life path? Well, there's no reason at all to think that her life path isn't the same as any man. That is to say, she, just as an individual, finds relative to her creator what path God has created for her, what path God has scripted for her. So she's in exactly the same position that any man is in, single or married. It's only the woman who chooses to marry a man who then has her life path mediated by who that man is. Okay? So let me pause there. That's an important enough concept that I want to make sure I have been as clear as I can.
Jack, thank you. Could you give some examples of what would fall under the rubric of a life path and what would not? Because I'm thinking about that relationship and I'm thinking about what it is that God tasked every human being with, and you could say broadly that, you know, all of us have been put on this earth to do business with the truth and to come to terms with our Creator and our need for mercy and things like that. And in that sense, Kelly can be a help to me in that, as well as I can be a help to her in that. But I suspect that that's not what you're talking about.
Right.
That. So could you give me some examples of, yeah, what falls under that rubric of life path?
No. It would include all kinds of things, like where in the world you go, where you live, your occupation, how you see your role before God in terms of advancing God's agenda, God's purposes in this world. Before I answer that question, let me make a further comment that I think in my mind, is intended to say, I don't have an answer to your question, but I don't think we need an answer to your question. That's what I'm intending to say here. For years, I've looked at this passage the way I think a lot of traditional Bible teachers have looked at this passage, as being Paul is intent on making sure that women be subject to their husbands, and that husbands make sure that they function as the head, right? So somehow, if the husband as the head doesn't function adequately as the head, and his wife doesn't submit to him as the head, it's going to rip a hole in the cosmos, and there's going to be a major problem that you're going to create because you have violated God's order. So let's really make sure that we are the head and that my wife is subject to me. Well, if I'm thinking that way, then answers to all the questions that rush into our mind about, well, okay, so what are the boundaries here? How should I behave? How shouldn't I behave? What's my responsibility? What's her responsibility? And all that become vital, because I've got to know that in order to be the head as God wants me to be the head, or be the etzer, the helper, as God wants me to be the helper. Okay, what we've seen is that here in Ephesians, the issue for Paul is not, can we make sure that all of you believers out there take your respective positions and stay there? That's not his concern. The concern is not, how do I be the head, or how do I be the etzer? The issue is that even valid any longer? Is that even a valid institution any longer? So his answer is, well, yeah, sure. I mean, if it's good enough for Adam and Eve, it should be good enough for us. I mean, it's a perfectly legitimate God-given relationship and institution. So that's cool. Just stay married. You wives, just go ahead and be wives. And in different cultures, that's going to look different ways. You know, what it means to be a wife is going to vary from culture to culture. But Paul is saying it's okay to go on being and looking like a wife. That's fine. You're not being disloyal to the Messiah by doing that. Now, do you see how that changes the emphasis? Because what I would argue is the husband being the head and the wife being the etzer comes naturally to us. We don't really have to work at it. That's where the traditional teaching, I think, has it backwards. They make it sound like it doesn't come naturally to us, and we need to make sure that we reshape ourselves and refashion ourselves and our marriages in the right kind of way, and let's really scrutinize them and make sure we get it right. I don't think that's where Paul's coming from. Husbands have been husbands and wives have been wives for thousands of years. It's not that hard. Well, you know what I mean. I think it's built into the psyche of a male and built into the psyche of a female to do what Adam and Eve did. They forged a relationship where Adam had his life path and Eve was happy as could be to be his etzer. And I think that's been happening for thousands of years. What Paul is saying is, Jesus has come into the world, it's okay for it to continue to happen. It's okay. No problem with that. So instead of this being some kind of burden that Paul is putting on us to make sure we create our marriages in a particular way, I think that's completely the wrong way to read this. Rather, he's just simply setting us free and liberating us against a couple of wrong ideas and false thinking that would lead us perhaps to think we need to rebel against the very institution. And that's really what he's saying is no more consequential than that, I think. So do you see how I don't want to answer your question because I think that's the wrong way to look at it?
I think so, but I think I need to think about it a little
Okay.
more. Thanks.
Okay.
So I think I understand what you're saying, that with Christ having come, that there's no need for us to try to change our loyalties or that kind of thing. But are you also saying that if a woman in a marriage has the predominant life path? So I'm thinking about people like, I don't know, I'm imagining like Margaret Thatcher or someone who, you know, some person, some woman who has a leadership role, whether in the world like Margaret Thatcher or just in her community or even in her household, and the husband plays the supporting role to her, is that wrong? I mean, that's sort of my question, like, is Paul saying that the husband has to be the main life path and the wife has to be the aitzer?
No, I don't think he would say that's wrong. I'm sure there's a number of things that need to be said in answer to that, and I'm not going to be able to come up with all of them. I probably haven't thought it through as far as I should, but I don't think he's saying that's wrong. I mean, you have examples of that. Deborah as the prophetess in the Old Testament. God, okay, we have to make a distinction between what our status and our visibility and our notoriety, or is that the right word? Our notoriety in the world is relative, as opposed to how we look and stand before God. Those are not the same thing. So a strong leader of a woman elected to some office with a lot of political power or economic power or something, is going to be very visible, perhaps, and very well known. And she may have a husband that nobody even knows her husband's name. But that doesn't change the fact that her attitude toward her husband, as known only by God, is what it is. You see what I'm saying? That she very well may still see that where their path has taken them, their path took them there because she was going along with her husband and helping him. And here's what helping ended up looking like in her particular situation and in her particular case. So I really don't think all marriages look different. They're very individual. And we are in no position to be able to pass judgment on how somebody else's marriage looks, and on the basis of some kind of superficial observations about what Paul is saying here in Ephesians, saying, oh, that's sinful, that's an unrighteous relationship, because look how much more notoriety the wife has than the husband. I think that would be a huge mistake. But that's why it gets very difficult to be precise, to analyze what exactly does it mean to be a helper and an aitzer. I mean, certainly, if a man has a path that he's on, and he recognizes and realizes this incredible talent and ability that his wife has, you know, he'd be a fool not to take advantage of that. Not to say, well, how you can help me is you can use your abilities, which are so incredible. You can use your incredible abilities in this particular way, and I think that's what we should do. I don't see Paul having any problem with that at all. But kind of the flavor of that and the spirit of that is very different from the flavor and spirit of a lot of the teaching that I was exposed to about Ephesians 5.
He devotes Breaker. He devotes two paragraphs to husbands loving their wives, which seems like a lot of space. It's important to him. As I read through it, there is a huge amount of focus and attention and energy that a man would have to expend to meet this, to live up to this admonition. Any man that says, "Yes, Lord, this I will do," is kidding himself, right?
Yeah.
I can't not imagine, other than Jesus doing it for the believers, any man being able to maintain this level of concentration and purpose and decision-making and activity to be the man that he's telling these husbands to be.
Right.
In forsaking his father and mother, which I'm assuming means until a man became married, the well-being of his parents as they aged was his responsibility. Number one, you see to it that they are cared for and safe. And then when he gets married, they become number two and three. It's not he just turns his back on his parents, but he prioritizes his life. His wife is almost all-consuming now. So what can one expect of a husband, or what could Paul expect of these husbands when he came back in 6 months or a year and said, "So how's that men's group, the husband's activity group going? How are they doing on being husbands? What's realistic, do you think? What did he expect?"
Well, what you're describing as what would be impossible is to love with the kind of flawlessness and perfection that Jesus loved with. But what's not unreal, it's not unrealistic to think that we could try to emulate his love. Now, we're going to do it imperfectly, and we're going to fail, and we won't have the wisdom to even know what love is sometimes because we're foolish, ignorant, sinful creatures. So we're going to fail, but hopefully it's not for lack of trying. Hopefully we have been captivated by the vision of emulating the love of Jesus. Love self-sacrificially. And to be loving self-sacrificially involves putting my wife's needs above my own, for example. I mean, that's not unrealistic. We as sinners don't do it naturally, but it's not unrealistic to expect that we could resist our sinfulness enough that we could begin to take steps toward being that other-centered in relationship to my wife. Does that make sense? Is that...
Well, it's a safe answer.
What unsafe answer would you prefer?
First of all, it seems like I'm not sure exactly the surrounding cultures here, but it seems like people outside the ecclesia would look at these people and going, "You're treating your wives as more than equal." I mean, they would find that odd that... the woman who can't go to war, the woman who can't trade labor for wealth, et cetera, whatever, is like you're treating her like she's just as important as you are,
mm-hmm.
which is true,
mm-hmm.
and which is what he's saying, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You're saying that in the decisions you make every day, you must first defer to your wife and say, "Can I give up this time between us in order to make more money? Or can I give up this time between us in order to serve on a committee or accomplish some end, whatever it is?" Because that time is devoted to her. It's already been set aside. It's hers to have from you. It seems,
I think you're making the same mistake that I was talking about earlier, going the other direction. The same mistake. I mean, we shouldn't come up with rules to follow. Here are the 15 rules for how to love your wife. It's more a matter of being focused on a particular perspective on who my wife is in relationship to me. As long as I've got that right, I'm going to make mistakes because I'm a sinner. I'm going to do some awful things because I'm a sinner. But as long as I've got that right, the rest of this headship, Aitzer stuff is going to take care of itself. It's not something I need to be all that self-conscious about and monitoring myself all the time about that. I just live my life knowing who this woman is that I'm married to and understanding she's God's gift to me. And we're going to go on here in this next paragraph. It's like she's my own body. She's as dear to me as my own body is dear to me. And as long as I have that perspective, then all the rest of it is going to come out in the wash. Okay? The other part of the question that was emailed to me was about Colossians. Paul has about five verses, covering the same ground in Colossians. I don't think he's saying anything fundamentally any different in Colossians than he is here. He words it differently. And there is one comment he makes that's not in here at all that if I don't want to comment on because I want to study Colossians first, but the general sense of what he's saying in Colossians is exactly the same, I think, from my perspective. Okay. So all of this for Paul starts from the Genesis passage in 2:24. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and his mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. In the past, I have always understood that Genesis passage to mean the two shall become as one life, as one being, if you will, as one entity. In other words, they are supposed to so completely and totally share their life that it's as if they are living the same life together as partners rather than two separate and independent lives. And I do think that's part of what he's saying, but there's another way of looking at it, and it seems to me that this is the way Paul is looking at it. Be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh, that is, one body. And what he means by that, what Paul understands that to mean, is, as I just said, if my wife is part of my body, then my concern to nurture, care for, protect, keep from harm is going to be as great as if it were my own body. I protect my own body. I nurture my own body. I try not to be embarrassed by my own body. There's all kinds of things I do treating my body in a particular way because it's me and I want to take care of me. And that, Paul's going to say, that comes really naturally. We're very, very adept at taking care of me and doing that naturally. Well, if I become one body with my wife, it means I've made a commitment, a moral commitment, to be as concerned about the well-being of my wife as I am myself. It's as if she's a part of my own body. Okay? And that's at least part, as Paul is reading it, that's at least part of or implied by what Genesis 2:24, if not exclusively and directly, what Genesis 2:24 means in Paul's interpretation. So with that in mind, let's look at the last paragraph on this section. Paragraph 34 starts with at 5:28. Just so husbands too ought to love their own wives just as they do their own bodies. Husbands should love their own wives just as they do love their own bodies. The one who loves his own wife loves himself. And so the point that he's making is that if in the marriage commitment the two become one, their well-being is mutually tied up together, by taking care of my wife, I am taking care of myself. Because her well-being is my well-being, just as my well-being is her well-being. So by loving my wife, I'm loving myself. Now, remember what he said in the paragraph up above that about Jesus? In the second sentence, this he did, that is, he cleansed it of sin. This he did so that he might present the ecclesia to himself as brilliantly glorious, having no blemish or wrinkle or any such thing, indeed, so that it might be holy and without defect. He wanted to present the ecclesia to himself, and I think the language is conjuring up the image of a bridegroom being presented with his bride. So why did Jesus die for the ecclesia? Jesus died for the ecclesia because he knew the purposes of God. He knew what God had in store. And what God had in store was creating a body of people who were going to be as if they were a wife to him. And in Revelation, remember, you have that image of the wedding feast, the feast where the bride is given to the bridegroom, Jesus. Jesus, the bridegroom, is coming back into history, and he's going to be married to the bride. That's the ecclesia. So it's as if Jesus has a marriage relationship to his bride, the ecclesia, the church, the assembly of believers. So why did he love the church? Because in loving the ecclesia, he was loving himself. In God's purposes and God's plans, he was going to end up being rewarded by having this ecclesia be without blemish or wrinkle or any such thing, and to be holy and without defect. One day he gets to reign over a group of people who are not a bunch of boring, obnoxious sinners, but are gloriously righteous beings. And he could look forward to that day and go, that'll be fun. I like that. So in dying for them, he's rewarding himself. So a husband is to treat his wife in such a way, sacrifice for her, nurture her, work to enhance her life, because in so doing, he's enhancing his own life. That's where he's getting all this. It starts from marriage, where, as we're going to see, Jesus being married to the church is just a metaphor, just an analogy. But the reality that he's basing it on is this commitment that a human male has to a human female. So just so husbands, too, ought to love their own wives just as they do their own bodies. The one who loves his own wife loves himself. Now, no one ever hated his own flesh. That's how naturally it is to love yourself. No one ever hated his own flesh. Rather, he nurtures and cares for it. So just as it comes naturally to nurture my own flesh, if my wife is one flesh with me, then I would be wanting to nurture her as much as I would want to nurture my own flesh. That's his argument. This is, as a matter of fact, how the Messiah is toward his ecclesia. Now he goes from husband or wife back to Christ in the church. This is, as a matter of fact, how the Messiah is toward his ecclesia, because we are members of his body. I think that's his way of saying, because we, as the ecclesia, are one flesh with Jesus, just like a husband is with the wife. And now he quotes the passage in Genesis to support that. For this reason, a man shall forsake his father and his mother and shall be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. Now, what's weird is he's quoting that passage to support his contention about Jesus and the ecclesia, not a husband and a wife. It goes without saying that it applies to a husband and a wife, but he's saying, but if you can dig it, that's kind of the relationship of Jesus to the Messiah. To the ecclesia. So for this reason, a man shall forsake his father and his mother and shall be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This is the great secret. And then he adds, I mean with reference to the Messiah and his ecclesia. So it's no secret that a husband is one flesh with his wife. The Genesis 2:24 says so. But what is a great secret is that that's the relationship of the Messiah to the ecclesia. It's as if they were one flesh. It's as if they shared the same body. And Jesus loves the ecclesia in the way that a husband who recognizes that his wife is one body with him, he loves the ecclesia like that. That's a great mystery. Nevertheless, but even though he says, I was talking about Jesus and the ecclesia, nevertheless, you husbands too, individually, each of you is to love his own wife in this way, even as himself. So husbands ought to love their wives as sacrificially as Jesus loved his ecclesia. And then offhandedly, and this wife and his wife is to see to it that she respects her husband. So Logan was pointing this out. Look at all of the energy that Paul devotes to the issue of husbands loving their wives in this passage. Virtually no energy to wives submitting to the husband, because he thinks that's just what women do. That's what marriage is. That's how marriage works. I mean, if you decide to get married, that's what you're deciding to do. So that's not really even problematic. The only thing that makes it problematic is when someone comes along and thinks that this is a revolution. Jesus has come into the world and dropped a bomb that blows up everything, including marriage. We shouldn't even think in terms of marriage any longer. Wives don't need to be subordinate to their husbands any longer. Okay, that Paul wants to say no to. No, marriage is still marriage. Marriage is still valid. It's still a valid institution. And so wives need to respect their husbands accordingly. But what? He spends two sentences on that, and all the rest of it is on the husband. Why? Because when you are in any kind of relationship where you have superordination and subordination as part of an asymmetrical relationship like that, the person who is superordinate can pervert their position and can use it for evil. And what Paul is saying here is to the people who are saying, you know, I don't know about marriage. I mean, shouldn't we just all be loyal to Jesus and Jesus alone and not any other human being here? And he's saying, no, it's fine for wives to be subordinate to and to respect their husband. That's fine. But you husbands, don't you dare pervert the place and position that your status as head in that relationship gives you. Don't you dare pervert that. You take as your example Jesus, who was head of the ecclesia, and how did he act? How did he behave? Did he fleece the flock for all they were worth? Is that what Jesus did? Did he belittle them? Did he humiliate them? Did he abuse them in any way whatsoever? Did he shut them up and silence them, make them invisible and insignificant? No, he died for them. And with the thought that they would be glorified, that they would be made holy and without defect, and would one day be a beautiful body of individuals that he would rule over. And he loved them to the extreme in order to make that happen. So do that, Paul says, do that. You be like Jesus was. If you're going to be head, be the kind of head that Jesus was. Okay, let me, to try to put this all together, I wrote this out because I don't know if I can do it succinctly if I'm just ad-libbing and talking. So if you don't mind me reading here, I want to read a summary of what I think this whole section from paragraph 32 to 34 is all about. The readers of Paul's letter to the Ephesians did not have a direct personal knowledge of Jesus. They did not hear him teach, they did not see him perform a miracle, and they did not directly experience his love, his humility, or his goodness. Like us believers today, they only knew Jesus from a distance. He was an idea. He was an abstraction. They understood the role he played, the claims that were made about him, and the importance that he had in God's purposes. But surely what loomed large in their minds was the fact that now, because of their belief in Jesus, they stood to receive mercy from God and to be granted life in the eternal age to come. Jesus had made them a part of the eternal people of God. Because of Jesus, God was now their God, and they were members of his people. That was the all-important truth that they believed on the basis of the gospel message. It would not be surprising, therefore, if in the thinking of some among them, Jesus himself had faded into the background. Obviously, he was a very important means to their blessed end. Clearly, he was a part of their theology, an essential component of how they understood the gospel. But he had already played his part. He had already accomplished his role. Thankful to Jesus, though they might be, it was not their relationship to Jesus that defined them. It was God who defined them. Fundamentally, they boasted in God, not Jesus. For their newfound identity was most importantly as a member of God's people. God was their God. In their imaginations, they stood before God as his child and served him as a member of his people. Because of their belief in Jesus, Jesus' followers stood before God as equals. Each and every one of them was a member with equal standing before God as a member of God's eternal people. Furthermore, it would not be surprising then if, in the thinking of some of these individuals, their loyalty to and service of God required that they know no other loyalty but to God. As God's people, they owed it to God to honor only him, to respect only him, to love only him, to serve only him, and to be loyal only to him. For was it not a form of idolatry to accept a subordinate position to any other being besides God? So did it not amount to dishonoring God for a woman to accept a subordinate role to her husband? It was to God that she was subordinate, and that gave her exactly the same status as any other child of God, including her husband, assuming her husband was a believer. Was it not a betrayal of that very fact if she accepted a subordinate role to her husband? Did it not amount to dishonoring God for a child to accept a subordinate role to his parent? It was to God that the Jesus-believing child was subordinate, and that gave him exactly the same status as any other child of God, including his parent, assuming it's a believer, was it not then a betrayal of that very fact if he accepted a subordinate role to his parent? And did it not amount to dishonoring God for a slave to accept a subordinate role to his master? It was to God that the Jesus-believing slave was subordinate, and that gave him exactly the same status as any other child of God, including his master, if he was a believer. Was it not a betrayal of this fact if he accepted a subordinate role to his master? The section of Ephesians that begins with 5:21 is written to counter this very sort of thinking among some of his readers. Their thinking is mistaken. They do not accurately understand God's purposes, and they do not accurately grasp the implications of those purposes. The faulty thinking of these individuals rests on a false assumption. They are assuming that as God's people, they owe it to God to honor only Him, to respect only Him, to love only Him, to serve only Him, and to be loyal only to Him. They're assuming that it is a form of idolatry to accept any subordinate position to any other being. But these are false assumptions. There is one fairly obvious counterexample to their assumptions: Jesus the Messiah. It is not a form of idolatry to accept and embrace a position of subordination to Jesus the Messiah. He is Lord and King over us. He is the most important member of the people of God. He is our Soter, our Savior. He is the focal point and defining member of our group identity. In other words, He is our head. Clearly, the example of Jesus puts a lie to the false reasoning that is tempting Paul's readers. We see in the case of Jesus a clear example of where accepting a subordinate position relative to Him does not amount to idolatry. To honor Jesus does not dishonor God. To fear and respect Jesus is not disrespectful toward God. It is clearly not disloyal to God to honor as head of God's people the Messiah whom God has appointed to that very role. As obviously true as all of this is, it is easy for the Jesus believer to lose sight of these things if Jesus has faded into the background. When one views Jesus as a very important means to his own blessed end and loses sight of the true nature of God's plans and purposes, then the fact of Jesus' exalted status among God's people is easily overlooked. So Paul begins this section by reminding his readers how necessary and appropriate it is that they stand in awe of or in fear of the Messiah. Only when we understand and embrace the subordinate role that the Messiah has over us will we be in a position to think clearly about all the other relationships in which we find ourselves. The false assumption that underlies the faulty thinking that Paul is combating is completely exposed as false when we recognize and embrace the superordinate position of Jesus the Messiah over us. But once we have seen that this false assumption is false, that is, once we have seen that as a child of God, I do not owe it to God to honor only Him, and so on, then I can see more clearly how to relate to other human beings. As a child of God, I can justly and righteously honor and respect others who might stand over me in other relationships in which I find myself. Obviously, God and Jesus must be my highest loyalty. If I am loyal to anyone above God and Jesus, then I am guilty of idolatry. But I am not betraying God or Jesus by honoring my given status relative to other human beings. As a wife, I can rightly honor and respect my husband as my head. I am not betraying God when I do so. As a child, I can rightly honor my parents. I am not being disloyal to God or Jesus to do so. And as a slave, I can rightly serve and obey my master. It is not disloyal to God or Jesus to do so. We can see Paul's point in this section then. Paul's purpose is not to instruct believers who find themselves in a subordinate role to adopt a specific behavioral style. He is not instructing them to be passive, compliant, meek, non-assertive, and quiet. Rather, Paul's purpose is to instruct believers not to reject the subordinate roles in which they find themselves. Righteousness does not require that the believer defy and reject the subordinate role in which he finds himself. Righteousness requires that he accept, embrace, and play that role to the glory of God and his Messiah. When Paul exhorts wives to be subordinate to their husbands, he is not instructing them to adopt a behavioral style wherein they are completely passive, utterly compliant, and striving to be as invisible, inconsequential, and insignificant as possible. To the contrary, they are partners to their husbands. They are their husbands' helpers. Certainly, they should behave as co-equal partners within their marriages. But it is utterly right for them to acknowledge and embrace the superordinate role and status that marriage gives to the husband in the marriage relationship. According to the account in Genesis, the woman was given to the man to be his helper, not the other way around. But to be a helper is not to be a slave and a servant. To be a helper is to be a co-equal partner in a partnership devoted to serving God in just that way that the husband has been directed by God to serve him. The husband's superordinate status derives from this. It is his service of God that defines the partnership, not the other way around. The wife commits her life to a man to help him fulfill his service. The man does not commit his life to a woman to help her fulfill her service. The man commits his life to serving God in the manner that God directs and then accepts the woman that God gifts to him as his helper. It is not the case that the woman commits her life to serving God in the manner that God directs and then accepts the man that God gives to her as her helper. It is an asymmetrical relationship. The husband is the head, the wife is the helper. A woman is rejecting Paul's instruction here if and only if she rejects this asymmetrical nature of her marriage relationship. She is not violating Paul's instruction here if she is an active, significant, creative, intelligent, assertive, and proactive contributing member of the marriage partnership. In other words, Paul is not instructing wives to shut up, fade into the background, and do whatever their husbands want. He's not instructing them to submit to their husbands in such a way as if they were animals, children, or slaves. In fact, he's not instructing them with respect to how they are to behave and interact with their husbands at all. Rather, he's instructing wives to be wives. For it is not a betrayal of her loyalty and allegiance to God to willingly accept her status as a wife. Indeed, it is no less valid and legitimate for her to accept her subordinate position as a wife and helper to her husband than it is for her to accept her subordinate position as a member of the Messiah's body, with the Messiah holding a superior position over her as her Lord. That is what Paul is instructing the women to do, and only that, with no more specificity than that. Anytime a sinful human being finds himself in a superior position over another human being, there is the very real possibility and likelihood of abuse. Indeed, an abuse of his superior position is what is normal among sinful husbands. God predicted as much in Genesis when he predicted to Eve, "Your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you." So Paul next turns his attention to the husbands and instructs them. Given the reality of their superordinate position over their wives, the husbands need to imitate how Jesus handled his superordinate position over his ecclesia. Jesus loved his ecclesia. He loved it self-sacrificially to the point of giving up his own life for it. He did not exploit his superior position to his own selfish advantage. Rather, he loved his ecclesia and nurtured it, to the end that it might one day be to him a beautiful and flawless bride. Indeed, he loved his ecclesia like he would love his own body. For mysteriously, The Messiah is like a husband to his ecclesia, and therefore it is as if he is one body with his ecclesia, for that is the nature of marriage. In just the same way, Paul says, husbands ought to love their own wives as they do their own bodies, for in marriage they have vowed to treat one another as if they were both part of one and the same body. So that's that. Let me, any follow-up questions to that?
Thanks, Jack. As you were talking, it occurred to me, Paul doesn't, by the end of this passage, this is not what he's drawing out, but he sort of references it earlier. But it occurred to me for the first time that in this sort of metaphor that he's setting up with Christ as the head, the church or the ecclesia is the etzer.
Right.
And there's some clarity, at least for me, that seems to come with that when, because going back, he talks about us being imitators of God, loving one another just like Christ loved the church. And so he kind of plays with this metaphor, but what he seems, I think you're really right when you're talking about the context and what he's exactly trying to warn them against, which is thinking that what God wants them to do in being loyal to God is to throw off this yoke of having to be in some kind of subordinate relationship. And no, marriage is still an important institution that God is using, in fact, using as like a picture of his grander plan and et cetera, et cetera. And this is really interesting that the church is sort of being called to serve God and to serve the Messiah. And that service then sort of, that it's sort of like there's ways that you can see that same kind of movement, I don't know, or dynamic, I guess, being repeated or replicated in these various roles that a person might find themselves in where they have to serve somebody else. And it's really that principle that God isn't just the kind of freedom that Christ is bringing is not freedom to be selfish. It's a freedom to submit to God and be able to act as God's servant in whatever role it is that he's placed us in our lives. Which is, I don't know, there's just something about that that was helpful for me. So I think I understand what you're saying when you say that those sort of specific rules, like coming up with rules, that kind of goes away and becomes not quite the right approach, because every person is in relationship and life that God gives them is going to require them to look at their relationships and assess, like, what is the role God's given me? How do I best serve in this situation? There are some really, like, natural boundaries that are put on men and women, it seems like, that we have to acquiesce to, and society provides a lot of that as well. Is that where you're going with
exactly
all this?
Yeah, okay. That's exactly right. Well said.
Thanks. Yeah.
Okay. Now, while I am taking issue with certain traditional readings of this, I'm not advocating what is usually typically the evangelical feminist position, which actually rejects the very idea of headship. And that's actually their position, I think, is close to the kind of position that he's actually arguing against. So just to be clear about that. Okay, now he moves on, and we only just have a few minutes. Let me just introduce this next issue, and that's children and parents. He goes on, "Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother. This is the first commandment with the promise, so that it may be well with you and that you may live long on the land. And fathers, do not provoke your children to anger. Rather, nurture them in the training and instruction of the Lord." Okay, we see here in the child, in the parent-child relationship, like the husband and wife relationship, and completely unlike the slave-master relationship, we see him go back into the Torah, into our Old Testament scriptures. he goes back and he basically argues that this is what God had in mind. This is what God designed. This has a purpose to it. So just as the marriage relationship has a kind of purpose to it, so does the child-parent relationship. And he gets at that by quoting, it's not exactly clear if he's quoting the Exodus passage or the Deuteronomy passage. There's enough textual variance in both of those that it could be either of those, just depending upon what the text was that he was looking at. Honor your father and mother is part of the Ten Commandments on Mount Sinai, and then that gets repeated in Deuteronomy by Moses. So that honor your father and mother, this is the first commandment with the promise attached to it, so that it may be well with you and that you might live long on the land. Okay, what's going on here? Well, in order to understand his point, we have to understand the Mosaic Covenant and what the Ten Commandments are all about, what Deuteronomy is all about. Remember that the covenant is a covenant between God and his people, Israel. I will be your God and you will be my people. Here are the terms of this relationship, of this covenant relationship. I want you to do this in order to fulfill your responsibilities as my people. And if you do this and fulfill your responsibilities as my people, here's what I'm going to do for you to serve as your God. I will bless you, I will protect you, I will bless you in all kinds of ways. So what he's promising them is, I'm going to take you to this land that I have given to you, I'm going to kick out all your enemies, or I'm going to help you kick out all your enemies, I'm going to give you peace in the land where you don't have to keep fighting to maintain the land. I'm going to give it to you and you'll be secure in the land. And I'm going to have your cattle have lots of little cattle and the grass of the field have lots of little grasses of the field. And I'm going to bring you abundance and prosperity and shalom in the land if you keep my commandments. That is, if you will be my people, keep my commandments and be my people, then I will be your God and I will take care of you. But if you don't keep my commandments, the land is going to vomit you out. And then he actually predicts that, you know what, Moses predicts, you know what, you're not going to do any of this stuff. You're going to go into captivity in Babylon for 70 years is what's going to happen to you because you're not going to do any of this stuff. So the issue of living long in the land is all about the nature of the covenant. I'm giving you this specific piece of real estate, and this specific piece of real estate I'm giving to you, you're going to live there in security and prosperity and live on and on and on and on in prosperity and security in that land if you keep my commandments. Okay? Well, Moses at least recognizes that how are you going to live on and on and on and on and on in the land then? It's one generation is going to have to pass down to the next generation who God is, what our relationship with God is, what the covenant is that he made with us, and what it looks like to keep the covenant. Parents are going to have to teach their children, because if parents don't teach their children, you ain't going to live long in the land. Because the children, if they don't know how to make me their God and be my people, then I'm gonna drive them out of the land. I will curse them rather than bless them. So the parents are going to have to teach their children. Now what Paul is doing is recognizing that that's kind of a universal built into humanity truth, that the purpose of parents is to pass on wisdom from one generation to the next generation. It's from my parents that I learn what this is all about, and I get oriented toward my existence and the nature of reality and so on. So I'm utterly reliant upon my parents doing that. Well, Paul goes to Deuteronomy or Exodus, whichever. he goes there and recognizes, look, Paul, Moses is recognizing this truth when he says what he says. Honor your father and your mother, because that's the first commandment with the promise, so that it may go well with you and that you might live long on the land. Paul is recognizing the role of the parent in the life of the child when he says that. So that's why he's giving that as support for children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. So what's right about it? Because it's the very nature of family as God created it and structured it to be, that parents would nurture their children. So does Jesus come into the world change all that? Does my loyalty to God as a new believer mean that I have to stop having any loyalty to my parents, stop listening to them, stop receiving instruction from them, stop gaining from their wisdom because I'm loyal to God and only God? No, he's saying no. God created the human family in such a way that it's through your parents that you as a child are going to be gifted with the wisdom that they have been given. So notice what he says here. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Other translations might translate it differently, but I think that's what Paul is saying. This is not an absolute... This exhortation is not absolute. Every parent, or every child everywhere, absolutely obey your parents all the time. It's not what he's saying. Obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Look to your parents for instruction about who Jesus was, what the role of Jesus was, what the significance of Jesus was, what Jesus taught, and so on. If you've got a monster for a parent who is giving you nothing but perverse garbage and not wisdom, you have absolutely no responsibility to obey that. And Paul is not saying that you are. You know, again, we have to avoid the tendency to absolutize things that were never intended to be absolute here. It's obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Where else are you going to get the kind of instruction you need except from your more experienced, older, more mature, more advanced parents who are created by God to play that role in your life? Okay. We're out of time. We'll come back next week and start with, and fathers, do not provoke your children to anger. He's going to do the same thing here. Just because you have a position of subordination over your children, don't you dare pervert it. You need to behave in a righteous way toward your children. So we'll look at that starting next week. Thank you.